Amen. Thank you, Brother Chris. Appreciate that. Some many years ago, when Sister Lynn and I lived in Las Vegas, she had a coworker that she respected very much, very skilled in the area and stuff. So just to be neighborly and whatever, she invited this coworker and her husband over to have dinner with us. And it turns out this coworker's husband was then the current pastor of one of the largest churches in Las Vegas and kind of one of the prominent places. I think even the mayor was a member at this church. So yeah, I think in addition to respecting her coworker and having more of just a professional but also a social relationship, she was hoping that, you know, maybe I would strike up a little bit of relationship with her husband, being someone who enjoyed reading the Bible and studying scriptures and discussing scriptures. Here was a minister, an ordained minister of a very large congregation. So after the meal, and we sat down and just kind of had some of that time to do that kind of thing. And of course, as an old Baptist, we're going to ask questions or ask, what do you think about this or scripture about that. Almost every statement I said, if I made a statement or question that I asked, the response was identically the same. His response was, well, that's where you're at right now, but that may not be where I'm at. And it was a way of avoidance is really what it was. And so after a while, we got tired of that and said, okay, well, I guess it's time for people to go. So that ended, and we never invited them over again. because if there's anything that certainly I enjoyed in those days and even today, if there's an opportunity to sit among God's people, whether it ministers, lay people, it really doesn't matter. Discuss what God's word and the things that have happened to us. I'm going to take that opportunity, and it's very enjoyable. Just as another example of that same time period and stuff, I would disappear from the house for multiple days on end. And Lynn knew where I was at, but I would disappear. And I would be staying about 60 miles north, but I would actually be staying in a little camper, me and Coy Thomas, with another man known as Troy Thomas. And Troy, of course, is more old Baptist than all of us in the room put together, having grown up in North Alabama, member at Union Primitive Baptist Church in Louisville, Alabama. His dad is Elder Gene Thomas, and he had heard preachers and preaching all of his life. So we would stay in that trailer and in the evenings and talk till midnight, 1, 2 a.m. in the morning about different scriptures, which was a little rough since he was usually on the job around 5 a.m. and then I usually had to drive another 90 miles from where we were at the time to be on the job by 7 a.m. So having about 2 to 3 hours of sleep was pretty rough on us, but I guarantee you those were the richest times in my young life visiting with what is now Elder Troy Thomas, and we still are great friends. That being said, this phrase that this man started giving me, this avoidance type phrase, that's where you are, but that's not where I am. Well, obviously that was just avoidance, but there's some teeth behind that, and it's kind of a question that the Bible sometimes strikes at the Lord's people. You know, where are you right now? And this brings to mind the scriptures in Philippians that Paul wrote to that church at Philippi, which was later in his ministry. Matter of fact, the letter to the church at Philippi was around 60 A.D., so we're getting kind of the end of that apostolic period, and by that time, Paul was a prisoner in Rome. So if you ask, where was he? If you ask Paul, where are you at right now? He said, well, I'm a prisoner and probably going to be executed here in just a few years. I might have another couple of years here and then I'm done. His life was almost over. I think he kind of sensed that. He was there in Rome. He was a prisoner. But his statement that he made, this is a famous verse that we often quote in Philippians. He says, and be found. Where was he wanted to be? He wanted to be found in him, not having mine own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the righteousness which is of God by faith. Where are you at right now, Paul? I don't know where I'm at right now. I don't know all the circumstances, but here's where I want God to find me. If he comes to me and says, where are you at? Or he calls my name, I want to be found, not having my own righteousness, but having his righteousness and living my life having his righteousness. I want to have a vision of the future, even if my future isn't going to last all that long. At the last couple of verses in that text, he says, brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. He had that vision. His vision was a mark of the prize of the high calling in Christ Jesus. He had a goal in his life, and it wasn't to end his life in prison. It was to daily serve the Lord. He wanted to be found by the Lord daily serving. So my question to you is, where are you at right now? I may or may not be able to articulate where I'm at, because that changes from hour to hour depending on what Sister Lynn tells me. So, because my priorities shift from time to time. But I tell you what, that is a question to God's people, and it's not an unusual question. And so to help you kind of answer that question yourself, because it's going to be different depending on who you are, I can certainly give you a series of examples in the Bible, mostly in the Old Testament. We'll get to the New Testament at the end, but in the Old Testament, there was men of renown, people that we know, people that we've heard about our lives. They were found of God. And it's kind of interesting what happens. And this is a repetitive thing that occurs with them. And they were in different situations, different things in their minds, different parts of their life, if you will. Yet God found them, and He found them in a mighty way. And when He found them, they had to respond. This was not an optional thing, but they had to respond. So let's kind of look at a few of these and go through that, and then maybe you too can identify maybe with one of these situations, or figure out yourself what your response ought to be or what it should be based on these men. Let's go with Abraham first. So Abraham, back in Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22 is where we're going to pick up with Abraham. Now, this is late in his life. This is not at the beginning. So we kind of know Abraham, how that he was, you know, we call him the father of the Jews, and he's recognized that. And the Jews in Jesus' day put great status on the fact that Abraham was our father as a Jewish nation, which I always thought was kind of interesting, since he actually, you know, ethnically wasn't Jewish. He was he was from Ur of the Chaldees, so he's Chaldean ethnically and from that region. That's just one of those little tidbits and stuff. Now, there is a reason why he came to be known as, actually was called Abraham the Hebrew, and that's because he ended up settling in the land of Canaan near a city or a town called Hebron, which you've heard of. So because he was kind of the wealthiest guy in that region around Hebron, they referred to him oftentimes as Abraham the Hebrew, because he lived in Hebron. And, you know, one thing led to another, and the name just kind of stuck, just like me. You know, when I was growing up, they called me Coy Boy, and that name kind of just stuck. So I'll be a boy my entire life, you know, no matter what happens. Same thing happened to Abraham. Now, Abraham, he left Ur of the Chaldees. He did that by trusting God. God called him and gave him certain promises. He told Abraham, look, trust me on this. I'm going to, you know, you get your whole family up, and you go to a land that I'll show you. In other words, I'm going to kind of guide you how to get there. I'm not going to give you a map. I'm going to guide you. So you'll have a dependence on me each and every day as you travel. But when you get there, this will be a land flowing with milk and honey. Oh, and by the way, in addition to this great land, I'm going to make you a very wealthy man. I'm going to make of you a great nation. In other words, you're going to have a big family. I'm going to give you a big family, and I'm going to bless you. And not only that, those other people around about you that bless you, I'll bless them. And those that hate you, well, I'll take care of them too. So he gave Abraham a whole series of promises. And Abraham, trusting God by faith, sojourned with his entire family and landed in the land of Canaan. Now, we understand that there was a few trials that Abraham went through. He had to go down to Egypt for a little while. He had to fight a couple of battles and defend a few folks. And he did some different things in his life. Probably one of the biggest trials of faith, if you will, that he had, or kind of understanding all these promises of God and God fulfilling these promises, was this whole big nation thing. And you remember that story, how that he questioned God. He said, how is it that you have promised that out of me will come a great nation, yet I have no children, seeing that I'm getting kind of old? About that time, he was about 90 years old, and Sarah being old too, he questioned God on that, said, this is not, this basically, we missed this one. Of all the promises, I've got several of them, but this one we kind of missed. And he had to go through that with God, and God kind of had to demonstrate to him that nothing is impossible. I always describe that is when that occurred, you know, Abraham asked God, he said, you know, there is none heir in my house. Shall this Eleazar, my servant, shall his children be my heir? In other words, he had a servant in his house named Eleazar that had children. There was his close servant that he treated, you know, almost like a son. He said, so shall this Eleazar and his family, will they be the great nation that you spoke of? Shall they be the heir of all that I've accumulated? And of course, God said, no, Eleazar shall not be, but one out of thy own loins, a man child from you and Sarah, that's going to be your heir. And to prove that I can do this, here's what I want you to do, Abraham. I want you to come outside the tent where we're having this conversation. I want you to look up into the night sky, and I want you to count the stars. That's simple. So Abraham goes out, and he looks up in the night sky, and he believed God at that point that there would be a child. Why? Because he saw the greatness of God in the heavens itself and said, God created all this, and I can't even count all the stuff that he's done. It dawned on him, why am I even questioning God on this? God can do this. This is not a problem for a God that can create anything and everything throughout the entire universe. Not a problem. So that was a revelation to him. But the last trial, the last test of faith that Abraham went through is here in Genesis chapter 22. So let's start reading in verse 1 and read about 10 or 14 verses there. It came to pass after these things that God did tempt or test Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, behold, here I am. And he said, take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell thee of. Now Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up, and went to the place of which God had told him. Then, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes, and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship, and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together, and they came to the place which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. I want to stop right there because that's kind of interesting. Abraham got caught in a situation here where he was being asked by God, well, this one promise that I gave you, this one that was kind of the toughest one for you to get over was to have a great nation, and I blessed you with this son, Isaac, who was a miraculous son that was born out of due time when it was physically impossible for you to have children. You had this son, Isaac. Oh, and by the way, I think if you carefully read some of the timelines here and try to put some of the things together, I think I make a good case that Isaac wasn't a little boy at this time. I think he was probably closer to, you know, maybe 19, 20, 21, 22, somewhere in that neighborhood. He was kind of a strong young man, so he wasn't, some little 7-year-old, 8-year-old. So Isaac had been there in Abraham's house, and Abraham had grown to love this young man and seen him grow up, and now God has asked him, give him as a sacrifice to me. Give him wholly to me as a sacrifice. Abraham obediently went forward and did that. He did everything that he could to honor that request that God had made, even though this was given up his son, his only son. And when they went up there, of course, I make a big deal about the phrase that occurs that Abraham said to the question. When Isaac asked, you know, Father, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? I've underlined twice. I put stuff around my Bible what he says. My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. The reason I say that is because you can, by emphasis, you can read it a couple of different ways. Either way you emphasize it, it is a great blessing to hear the words of Abraham about what God will do. When it comes time to be offered, Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb. In other words, God will get his own lamb. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about what we have or don't have. We've got everything that God has given us. And I'm going to go up and do what God tells me to do, but my son, my confidence is in the Lord. He will provide a lamb. There's no lamb here, but he's going to provide one. So the emphasis there is on the lamb. My son, God will provide himself a lamb, his own lamb. Not one of my lambs, his own lamb out of his own flock. He'll provide that. Or, if you emphasize himself, God will provide Himself a lamb for the offering. In other words, He's saying God will provide Himself, Jesus Christ, as His own lamb. See that? Either way, whether you emphasize the lamb or you emphasize Himself in that verse, it works. Because when it comes down to it, that's what He's saying. God will provide Jesus Christ, His own lamb, Himself, verily God in the flesh. He will provide Himself to be the sacrifice that's required. And you know what? That's exactly what happened here. Now, it happened kind of in type and shadow, but it's very real about what occurred next. And I, like I said, where did God find Abraham when He called out to him? And He calls him twice. You know, that's always a key. You know, the boys know this. When your mother calls both, you know, all your names, you know, your first, middle, and your last name, you know you need to respond. You don't need to, you know, not respond. You need to say, "Here I am," right? When your mom calls your name out, and I know when I was little, if my mom yelled out my name and yelled all three, you know, all three names or anything else she could think of, that's the time to respond and not be quiet. Same thing with God. When He calls your name twice, Abraham, Abraham, Abraham's response is, "Here I am." Stop, wait, the world is on hold. The Lord just called out, and He called my name twice. So this means He wants my attention. You know, there's going to be times in our life, and I know you've probably seen this, God gets our attention. He calls our name out a couple of times just to wake us up and rattle our cage just a little bit and get us out of our comfort zone. And when that occurs, your response is, "Here I am." "Here I am, Lord. What do You need to let me know?" And this is the same thing with Abraham. The instruction was, He said, "Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him, for now I know that thou fearest God." Or in other words, thou respects God, seeing that thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. Oh, those are interesting words that our King James Bible has. I wouldn't trade this for anything in the world. He says that, you know, his eyes were downtrodden when God called him out, Abraham, Abraham. He was looking at the altar. He was praying. I'm sure he was looking at the ground. I'm sure he was doing everything in his might to fulfill what God had said, knowing all the while, "I could lose my son here in a minute, and I'm going to be the cause of that loss because God has required it at my hand." And yet God calls out from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham, here I am." And He says, "Lay not thy hand on the lad, for I know beyond any reasonable doubt, I know it's in your heart that you respect and fear God and would follow through without cause, but don't do that. There is no need for that." And it says, then Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked to see something, and he saw a ram. He saw a ram caught in a thicket. Well, let me tell you something, folks. Rams don't get caught in thickets. If you actually go do just Google it or whatever you want to, rams don't get caught in thickets. If you ever, you know, you've seen, you know, National Geographic or pictures or something, ram's a pretty tough animal, and its main defense is its head, right? With those big horns. Those don't get caught in a thicket. You can get out of anything. They could tear a tree out of the ground with those horns and stuff. A ram is a tough animal. So you got to ask yourself, what's going on here? How did this occur? That's because God Himself caught this ram with a thicket. Just think about that. So what did Abraham see when he looked up? He saw this animal in this thicket. In other words, think of it as like this shrub just full of thorns on it. You know, this kind of this viney, thorny-looking thing that's growing there, and this ram whose head is in there, and he's probably been trying to wrestle with that just a little bit, and so there's probably, you know, the thorns have probably hit his head just a little bit, and there's probably some blood coming down. Are you starting to get in the picture here? Yeah, you're starting to see somebody else that's not a ram. You're seeing a man whose head was caught in a thicket when they crowned him with a crown of thorns and blood flowed down his face. That's what Abraham saw. He saw that. He lifted up his eyes and he saw that. And then the next verse it says that he offered this burnt offering instead of, or in the stead of, his son. The son that was required to be offering was his, was spared, and God's own son was offered in his stead with his head caught in a thicket and crowned with thorns. You see that picture that was just painted there? That's a beautiful picture. This explains why over in John the 8th chapter when Jesus was discussing with some Pharisees who didn't get all this, and they laid claim to the fact that we have Abraham to our father. Who are you to tell us anything? Abraham is our father. We follow Abraham. We're his descendants. We can't learn anything from you. Jesus' response to that, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Up there on Mount Moriah, Abraham saw the day of Jesus Christ, and he rejoiced in it, and he was glad. See that? That's what that verse was actually referring to. It was referring to that instance up there. But here's the key. When God calls out, you might be in the trial of your life. You might be being tested by faith. But in truth, this was not a test of Abraham. This was an object lesson to Abraham that God was going to give him. You bring your son up, it sounds like a test. It sounds like, I want to try your faith one more time. But it really wasn't. What God was trying to do is, I want to show you an object lesson. I want to show you the full salvation of God in pictures. I want you to know that your son is being required, that judgment has come down, and you sinners are required at the hand of God as a sacrifice unto him. But here's what I want to have happen. I want to call your name out. When I call, you say, here I am, and you too will lift up your eyes, and you'll see Jesus Christ as the offering instead of you. That's what I want you to see. See that beautiful object lesson? Let's go on and do another one. So after Abraham, you have Jacob. Well, Jacob's just a few more chapters over in Genesis chapter 46. And of course, we love studying Jacob because the words rascal, liar, and deceiver usually come to mind when I first think of Jacob. So that's not a good place to start. But when you look at your life sometimes, Jacob could have had a lot of regrets in his life when he looked back. Certainly, he started his life in a bad way, deceiving and getting the blessing from his father Isaac instead of Esau. He lied about a few other things. He was just, like I say, I think, you know, the name Jacob actually means deceiver. I like the word rascal. I think that's a better description of what he is. But I think he finally came to the point where he understood that the God of his father Abraham, the God of his father Isaac, was his God too, and he needed a double portion of grace from his God, and he got that. God blessed him in a mighty way, and that great nation which had started with Abraham and then with Isaac, it flourished under Jacob, and that's really where Israel came from. As we recall, Jacob, God changed his name from Jacob to Israel. And that's where the name Israel or Israelites came from. And, of course, all 12 tribes were his sons. But, you know, Jacob had to undergo a couple of trials in his life. And earlier on in his life, you know, the thing we understand is the story of Joseph, his son, not his youngest, but his next to the youngest son, Benjamin being the youngest son. And Joseph, of course, was sold off into slavery, but he didn't know that. He was told by his other sons that a terrible beast had, you know, ripped Joseph to pieces, and Joseph was dead, and all we have is the coat that you gave him with some bloodstains on it, and that's all that was there. So the sons, he'd gone for most of his adult life knowing that he had lost his next to the last son, one of his favorites, actually, and he grieved that loss. So when we come to Genesis chapter 46, and later on, when he stands before Pharaoh as they go down into the land of Egypt, which is what this chapter is about, Pharaoh actually asked him, you know, general questions to understand, you know, what's your occupation, you know, who are you, what's your life been like? And his response to Pharaoh, he says, few and evil have the days of the years of my life been. In other words, Jacob said, if you're asking about my life and to give my life in summation, it's not been that many years. At the time he said that, he was about 130 years old. So he said, I was kind of young. He says, well, the reason he said that is because he was younger than Isaac when he died, and he was younger than Abraham when he died. So he says, I've had less years than my fathers had and those before me. He said, so my years have been few and evil is how I would describe my years. You are not wrong, Jacob. He was very truthful in that. That being said, you get an idea of where was he? Where was he in this part of his life, at the end of his life, this kind of this last little decision that had to be made with this great blessing that he had of God? He had this great nation. He had wealth in Canaan. He was living the life. He was worshiping God, just kind of smoothing on out. He grieved over the loss of his son, Joseph, never to see him again. And then all of a sudden, in chapter 46, his sons show up and say, Joseph is still alive. You know, if you back up just before that, it says, and they told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. and Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not. I think that's an interesting verse, and you ought to underline that one in your Bible. See, this is one of those things about belief and what it does and doesn't do. In this instance, Joseph was alive, and as we know from reading the story, he was second only to Pharaoh in Egypt, governor of the entire land, and he was in a high esteem there. The brothers came and finally discovered that, found that their brother was still alive, and that he was going to have grace. And of course, Joseph wasn't, "I'm not mad at you. I'm not looking for revenge. God has blessed me to be in this place, and now I can bless and help my family. God has helped me to help you." So he was glad for it. So these brothers come back and tell Joseph, "We saw him. He's alive." And Joseph's first response is, "I don't believe you." Did that make it any less true? No, it did not. Did that change the status of Joseph being the next to the last son of Jacob? No, it didn't. So his unbelief, if you will, did not change his relationship or the facts. The facts are the facts, and they cannot be changed. You know, it's kind of interesting that oftentimes people are recorded in the New Testament after going to the grave and seeing it empty and then seeing him alive, reported to disciples and apostles, the family of Jesus Christ himself, and they said, "I don't believe you. I don't believe it." Unbelief was a common reaction to, "He's alive." Did it change it? No. Did it change the relationship? No. Their belief had no bearing whatsoever, with no dependency upon the relationship that they had with Christ and with God. Their discipleship, what had been accomplished, had no interest in that. However, it did diminish the joy that they experienced once they saw him themselves, and once they realized he is alive, he is exactly who he says he is, and he accomplished everything he said he would. There's your joy when you finally get to see it. And of course, they see it. We don't get to see it with our physical eyes, but sometimes in the scriptures that we read, we can see things like that ram caught in a thicket and say, "I can see Jesus Christ." The same way that we can lift up our eyes sometimes when God calls our name, when we say, "Here I am," and we can see Jesus Christ for all that he's worth, and we get joy when we believe that. So belief does have an important part, but it does not change your relationship one way or the other. Now, Jacob, at this point, is invited to gather up everybody and go down to Egypt. Now, right off the bat, that just doesn't sound like a good idea to me. When you're living in Canaan in a land flowing with milk and honey, and you have wealth, and you're enjoying the very promises that God gave Abraham and Isaac, why in the world would you want to leave other than the famine going on? But, you know, if it were me, I would think, you know what? God will get us through the famine. Let's just stay here. We'll figure it out. God will provide water out of a rock if he has to. You know, like he hadn't done that yet, but I'd be thinking that. I'd be thinking, you know, he can squeeze water out of a rock if he had to. So I wouldn't want to leave. I think Jacob was kind of that way too, and that's why he had a major decision in his life. So he traveled just a little ways. He gathered everybody up, and he started going, and they got to the no turning back point. It's actually a kind of an interesting place that you can study in your Bible. It's called Beersheba. Beersheba is at the southernmost end of Canaan land. Beersheba is the last place that you can get water before crossing a desert to get into Egypt. So if you don't fill up, if you don't water your flocks there, if you don't water everybody, if you don't fill up water, you will not make it across the desert. Kind of interesting, the well that was there, that was a well that was dug by Abraham. It was a special well. You remember, this was the well that Abraham dug for his people, where he actually paid for it. First, he dug it, and he was using it for his flocks. Then the sons of Abimelech got kind of jealous about it, so they kind of took it over. And so Abraham had a meeting with Abimelech, who actually was the kind of the ruler of that general area, and told him what had happened. Abimelech said, "I didn't know anything about this, and this is the first time that I've heard anything about it. Thank you, Abraham, for telling me." And Abraham says, "But we're going to do this the right way. So there's a way to do this. You don't just give it back." He said, "I'm going to pay for it." So he paid for it with some different animals. But then he gave him a special payment of 7 ewe lambs, complete payment. And he wanted Abimelech to witness of him finish, he undid the well and did some other things to it and got it ready to go. He said, "Now you know that I've done this. This is my well for my people, and you know that." So it's kind of a famous place there in Beersheba where that agreement took place between Abimelech and Abraham, as well as that well that was drawn there. And now all of a sudden, a couple of generations later, you have Jacob showing up there to water. And what did he do while he was there? He needed to consult with God for just a little while. So let's take it up in Genesis chapter 46, verse 1. and Israel, or Jacob, took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifice unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of the Father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. Let's just stop right there. God responded. It's like, this is a big decision. We oftentimes have big decisions in our life. Who do I marry? Who do I move? What job do I get? What school do I go to? There's all kinds of big decisions in our life. Nothing wrong with doing exactly what Jacob said. If you're uncertain and unsure, you stop. You stop at a Beersheba. You get some watering well. You stop at a local Trinity Baptist church, if you will. You go and you hear some sermons. You spend some time in meditation and prayer, and maybe God, in His infinite wisdom, will call your name twice. Jacob, Jacob. And you know what to say. Here I am. Here I am, Lord. Tell me what I need to do. In this instance, God says, don't fear to go down in Egypt. If you go down in Egypt, I'll go with you, which is the key point. You know, like I said, God could keep them in Canaan land and squeeze water out of a rock, but even better, to go down into Egypt and God says, I'll go with you. You won't be alone. So I'm not going to stay up in Canaan land and just bless Canaan land. I can go down into Egypt with you, and surely, if I go down with you, I will surely bring you out again. And while you're there, I'm going to make of you a great nation. You shall prosper down in Egypt. That is not something that I would have concluded if I'd looked at that situation, yet God can bring those things to pass. When He says, Jacob, Jacob, here am I. What do I do? What's the right decision, Lord? Go down to Egypt. It's okay. I'll be with you. You know, there might be situations in your life where you're called to go somewhere and you're thinking, man, I don't know if I should be going that direction. Or you're called to do something and I'm just not 100% sure. You need to find out if God's going to say, I'll go with you. If God's going to go with you, as we sing about it, I can go anywhere. It doesn't matter where I go. You know, I'm sure back in about 2002, I am proof positive sure that Elder Gus Harder was in this exact same situation. And he was wondering, should I really uproot all these kids that I have in the land of my nativity, where I've got everything made right here, and go to the Philippines and labor in that field? I think God called out, said, Gus, Gus, fear not to go into the Philippines. I'll go with you. And you know what? I'll get you some more kids. I'll make your family great, right? and you will prosper down there. And not just you, my people will prosper down there. And you know what? When it's time, surely I'll bring you back. Yes, I think Brother Gus said, here am I, Lord, and he obeyed that, and he did not fear to go there. If you know Gus Harder, he did not fear one bit. He went, and he prospered there, and I was thankful for that, but I think that's a great example. Next one, Moses. Moses is just a few more pages away over in chapter 3 of Exodus. Of course, Moses was somebody who had been blessed by God literally from birth, who was, you know, slated to be killed as a newborn man-child, but was saved by water in the ark, not the big ark, but the little ark made out of bulrushes. And Pharaoh's daughter, of course, found it. He grew up in Pharaoh's house. However, you know, despite the fact that God had overwatched Moses from his birth on, Moses himself sometimes, I don't think, quite got it. And, of course, growing up in Pharaoh's house can change your perspective. We always have the debate, you know, where I'm at right now, is that a function of my environment or did I inherit that? And in my instance, a lot of it is inherited, by the way. I'm not going to blame my environment. I'm going to blame my ancestors the way I am. And after a couple of meetings and stuff with them, it's like, yep, it all makes sense now. I know exactly why. Another good example of that is Sister Lynn, of course. When she does certain things, just, you know, mentally, I'm thinking, well, Hannah, why'd you do that? Because those are the things that Hannah does that she hates so much. Now I know where Hannah got it from. She got it from her mom. So it was all genetic. It was not environmental. It was all genetic. And of course, Hannah doesn't appreciate her name being used as a derogatory term to correct her mom. She didn't think that's appropriate either, but I think it's fine. So Moses, you know, as you know, got into a little bit of trouble over in Egypt. He did kill an Egyptian, and he ran. You know, he ran from the law, he ran from justice. And so you kind of find Moses, if you ask that question, well, Moses, where are you at right now? Well, here I am. I'm in Midian, the desert, on the backside of the desert, actually. And I like the words that it says. It says, and now Moses, in chapter 3, verse 1, now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father, in the his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. I think it's kind of interesting that Moses, who ultimately was the messenger of God to the children of God, the Israelites, he's going to be a messenger, but what was his duty? Keep someone else's flock. He didn't have any flocks. He didn't have anything. He was broke. But he was keeping someone else's flocks. You know, that's a type and shadow of Old Baptist preachers. Most of them are broke, and the flocks that they tend to, they don't own. They're owned by Jesus Christ himself. They just get to tend them, and sometimes they find themselves on the backside of the desert, tending Jesus Christ's flock, completely broke, wondering what's going on. That's an Old Baptist preacher for you in a nutshell. That's what Moses was. He says he kept the flock on the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. By the way, Horeb is part of a mountain chain that includes Mount Sinai. You know that, right? So this experience he's going to have with this burning bush, that's where he got the law. Same general area, same mountaintops. You know, those are the same places. And actually in this discussion that goes on, God says that. God says, once I bring you out of Egypt, I'm going to bring you back to this very place we first met, and we'll go on from there. But here's what he says, and the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called on him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. Are you starting to see a trend here with these men? That God calls them, Jacob, Jacob, Abraham, Abraham, Moses, Moses, and in every instance they say, here am I. Here I am, Lord. You're calling my name. I know who you are. You're calling me. Here I am. What's the instruction here? So here's what he says. And he said, draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou hast standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Why was he afraid? Because he was running from law. Because he killed a man and kind of gotten away with it. Because he was hiding out on the backside of the desert. He didn't want to be found. He didn't want to be found of anybody from Egypt, much less anybody from Israel, or God himself. He didn't want to be found. You know, there's times in our life, and there's been times in my life, I don't really want to be found. I don't want people to know where I'm at. I want to hide a little bit. I want to go on the backside of the desert, kind of tending somebody else's flocks, pretending like I'm, you know, some Midianite when in actuality I'm an Israelite. I want to do that. And those are the very time when God has come to me and said, Coy, Coy. And I have to answer, here am I. And then I get some instructions. And in this is one of the longest exchanges of any individual in the Bible with God himself. Was this burning bush thing. This actually goes over about a couple of chapters long if you actually read it. And when you read it, it's real simple. God says, Moses, I'm going to send thee back into Egypt. I've heard the cries of my people down there. And remember how, and he didn't say this, but you remember how he told Jacob, I'll go down and surely I'll bring you up again? God's saying, now's the time. Now's the surely time when I'm going to bring them up again. I've heard their cries. I've seen their sorrows. And I want you to go and help and bring my people out of Egypt. So every time God would say something to that effect, Moses thought up a reason why he didn't want to do that. Well, Lord, when I go, they won't listen to me because they don't even know who you are. They don't know your name. What's your name? And he said, well, you tell them my name. I exist as is. You know, I don't have a name per se. I just exist. I'm a being. I'm a God. I don't have a name. So you just tell them my name is I am, because I am that I am. And that's all he's saying. But he goes on, he says, so here's the way you do it. He actually gives him very unique instructions. So when you go, you gather the elders of Israel together, and you say, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac, the God of your father Jacob, the great I am, has spoken to me and sent me to bring the people out of Egypt, and they'll listen to you. And he said, well, but what if they don't? you know, how will they know? They won't believe that you actually spoke to me, even if I say that. They're just saying, well, you just made that up, right? You had a vision. You were on the backside of the desert. You got thirsty. You dehydrated. You had a vision. You know, go back to the desert. So what will they believe me? And so God had to walk him through step by step by step by step. And he went very reluctantly, even to the point, as you know, he had to appoint one of his kinsmen, Aaron, who eventually became the high priest, Aaron, to help him go. He had to get like a running mate, a buddy to go with him so that people would believe him. As we know, the story still worked out. But this is early on in Moses' life when God calls out to him. And God directed him to go and do that and said, I'll go with you. I'll be there. And he would even walk him through. He told him up front, says, you're going to go to Pharaoh. You're going to tell Pharaoh, Pharaoh, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, has commanded that let thy people go 3 days' journey out in the wilderness to worship him. And God told him up front, and Pharaoh will say, no. I already know that's what's going to happen. And he walked him through it. So Moses had to go through all this stuff, pretty much being drugged the whole way or doubting the whole way. Read the story very carefully in your Bible and you'll see that. You'll see that Moses came up with excuses or reasons, but as things went along, it seems he got a little bolder and a little bolder and a little bolder. You know, I've often preached on this whole concept of over in Romans where it says, and Pharaoh hardened his heart, or I hardened Pharaoh's heart, and so on and so forth, and about the plagues that would occur before he actually released, and how that's actually it's analogous to how you make steel. So you start with steel, and you end with steel, but it's hardened steel. Those are two different things. You can have soft steel and hardened steel. So you mix the elements together, and the way you do it is you like when you make a blade or a sword, a very fine sword or a fine blade that's made, you pound it out, kind of get the general shape, and then you put it in a fire, and you heat it up. And then after you've heated it up, then you quench it. You put it in water, and then you beat on it some more. So then you beat on it, you heat it up, you quench it. You go through this process. And the more you do that, what you're actually doing is you're purifying that steel, and it's hard. It's a hardening process is what that's called. That's what the plagues were. God would heat up Pharaoh, if you will. He would heat up Pharaoh with a plague. And then it would all diminish. He would quench him, and they would have Moses and Aaron go beat on him a little while and say, now let my people go. And he would get hard. He would get like hardened steel. Now realize, you start with steel, you end with steel. Nothing changes in the middle other than you get hardened steel at the end. And the reason God did that was to show, and he says over in the Roman letter, I did this on purpose. Because at that time in the entire world, the largest, most advanced empire and civilization was Egypt. You know, this is during the time when, you know, and archaeologists and historians all agree, those big pyramids and the big structures that were there in the capital of Egypt, everybody know where the capital is? Because it ain't what you think it is. You know, y'all think that, you know, the Cairo is the capital, right? It is not. Memphis, man. Memphis, Egypt. You know, just like Tennessee, Memphis. That's the capital. So y'all who watch movies and, you know, they have some ancient thing that comes out of the basement there in Cairo somewhere, you know they got that wrong. They're historically inaccurate. That was Memphis is where all that stuff was at. So the Sphinx, the pyramids, and if it's not there, it was at Luxor was a lot of the pyramids. So Luxor and Memphis were the two big metropolitan cities. Cairo hadn't even thought of yet. That was just a creek on the road, you know, nothing there. Anyway, I digress. Let's go forward. So Moses, the reason that occurred is so that this great empire and all this great civilization that God could say, look, you're slaves to the greatest empire, to the greatest ruler of that empire. Now, I'm going to take that ruler, I'm going to make him even meaner than he already is. I'm going to harden his heart, I'm going to harden him so that there's no way possible he would ever let his you know, the wealth of his nation, the economy of his nation is built on slaves who built all that, right? Why would you let your workforce go? Free labor. So why would you do that? Doesn't make any sense. And no one can make you because there's no one big enough to make you. So that's what God was trying to do. He was trying to get the whole situation to a point where there was no question. And yet God says, not only will I do it, but I'll do it without lifting a hand or firing a shot or raising a bow or anything. He says, in fact, when you leave, You get your little ones and your women, you get them ready because the Egyptians will want you to go so bad. They will throw jewels at you and gold and silver and put clothes on you just to get you out of Egypt. And that's what happened. That actually happened. So, again, Moses not looking for God, not looking for any purpose from God, not looking for a life mission from God, not really wanting to make any decision other than don't be found. That was the only decision he made. I don't want to be found. God comes to him and says, Moses, Moses. And his only response is, here am I. Here am I. Last one is Samuel. And I like Samuel so much because it starts with not the story so much of Samuel, but of his mother Hannah. And if you really want to know, yes, my daughter Hannah is named after Samuel's mother, not named after some aunt or somebody else that you might think of. It's taken directly out of the Bible as the mother of Samuel. So in Samuel chapter 3, 1 Samuel chapter 3, and just by way of background, so Hannah had not born any children. She had not had any children thus far between her and her husband. And because, she was getting older, she was actually being ridiculed by other ladies. And there's certainly a lesson there to be very, very careful and respectful of our young folks, especially, young married couples and everything. It seems like as soon as a young couple gets married, they go off for a honeymoon. As soon as they get back, everybody asks, so when are you going to have children? That's the first thing that comes out of their mouth. Give them some time, for crying out loud. Sister Lynn and I, Hannah didn't come along until we'd been married for 5 years. So they've been quite a while. And you know what? That's a little bit of a blessing. It's a blessing because as we've told the girls when we talk with them, we talk about going to San Diego to SeaWorld and the Wild Animal Kingdom and going to San Francisco and just doing all these great things. It's like, we went and did and had a life before you guys came along, and then it all went downhill. So, and they're pretty irritated us that they find out that mom and dad, and we have pictures too, they find out mom and dad lived the life as just young people without a care in the world, going here, there, and yon, and going down the water park at SeaWorld in San Diego, things like that. It's like, well, where are we? You weren't born yet. Well, when do we get to go? Never. Do it on your own dime. I would caution folks when young people get married and stuff like that. Having children is not the first question. There's lots of other things, and there'll be time for that. In due time, God will bless them if they so do that. But if God does not, and for any reason they can't, you need to be careful about this, because this was the situation Hannah was in. It grieved her greatly being ridiculed by other women because she had not conceived, because that was a mark of being an Israelite woman, that you could conceive this man-child and all this other stuff. And she would go and pray and pour out. She did exactly what she's supposed to do. She went and poured out her sorrows. She went out and poured her complaints at the temple of the Lord himself, and the Lord heard her and blessed her to have this man-child called Samuel. But in her prayer, she said, Lord, if you would bless me to have a healthy man-child, this young son of mine, I will give him totally devoted to you. I will give him over to the service of the Lord completely and fully for his entire life. Now, I'll still be his mom, I'll still see him and all that other stuff, but I'm going to turn him over to you. And that's what she did. She made good on that. And as soon as he was old enough, they would go back to the house of God. It was actually to Shiloh is where they were at. And he became sort of it wasn't indentured because there was no debt to be paid. He became more or less the property of the temple that was there and the priesthood that was there. And he became a young man who served there. And to him, you got to think about that. To young Samuel, the world was a little bit different than other young men his age. Other young men were at home and participated in activities and stuff like that. He was not. He saw his mother like once every year at best when they would come up to worship there or things like that. Otherwise, he was a servant in the Lord's house, but he was happy to do that. He had his daily duties. He cleaned up here. He did this. He made ready that. He did what he was supposed to do. When we pick up here in chapter 3, he's still a young boy. He's not that old. And it says, and the child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli, who was the priest at that temple. And the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision. I want to just stop right there to clarify what that saying is. It says the word of the Lord, what they had knowledge of, the stories of Abraham and Isaac, the story of Moses, the story that was in the Judges and of Joshua, those things that they knew was precious. Why? The same thing that anything has value, because it's scarce. You know, anything of value means that you don't get a lot of it, and what you got is better than everything, anything else. So gold is precious because there's not a lot of it and has really unique properties, and a little bit of it's worth a lot. The word of the Lord is exactly like that in those days. They didn't have a lot, so what they had was of high value. And in addition to that, there was no open vision. Literally what that's saying is there was no man of God. There was no authorized prophet in that day who could say, the word of the Lord came to me and I spoke to Israel saying, you know, like when we read in Isaiah or we read in even Daniel or we read in any of the minor prophets, that's what they say. In the days of King Cyrus or the days of King Hezekiah, the word of the Lord came to me and I, Haggai, spoke. So that's what was happening. Usually in this day, that did not occur. There was no prophet. So that was kind of a new job, so to speak. There was no one delivering the prophecies of God or speaking God's word to people, folk. So, and it came to pass at that time when Eli was laid down in his place, his eyes began to wax dim that he could not see. And ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was, and Samuel was laid down to sleep, the Lord called Samuel, and he answered, "Here am I." Well, wait a minute, Brother Coy. I thought, you know, you called twice. Well, keep reading. And he ran to Eli and said, "Here am I, for thou callest me." And he said, "I called not. Lie down again." And he went and laid down. And the Lord called yet again, "Samuel." And Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, "Here am I, for thou didst call me." And of course, Eli answered and called, said, "I called not, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, neither was the word of the Lord yet revealed unto him. And the Lord called Samuel again the third time. And he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here am I, for thou didst call me." And Eli perceived that the Lord had called the child. Therefore Eli said unto Samuel, "Go, lie down, and it shall be, if he call thee, that thou shalt say, 'Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. And the Lord came and stood and called as at the other times, "Samuel, Samuel." Then Samuel answered, "Speak, for thy servant heareth." There you go. There's that double one. Samuel, Samuel. See, he'd been calling him Samuel every time, and it's like he didn't get it. He didn't know this was the Lord calling him. So he kept going to Eli. "You call for me, master?" It's like, "I did not call for you." Finally got a little bit of instruction. He said, "This is the Lord calling you." And when the Lord wants to get your attention, he'll call your name twice. And all you need to say is, "Speak, thy servant heareth. I'm here to serve you." See, Samuel, as a young boy, understood instruction. He understood that when the Lord calls you, "Here am I, speak, thy servant heareth." Let's wrap up with the very last one over the New Testament. Acts chapter 9. Verse 1, "And Saul, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went in unto the high priest and desired of him letters to Damascus, to the synagogues, that he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem. And as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined round about him a light from heaven, and he fell to the earth, heard a voice saying unto him, 'Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?' And he said, 'Who art thou, Lord?' And the Lord said, 'I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks.' And he, trembling and astonished, said, 'Lord, what will thou have me do?'" Let's go back to our original question. Where are you at? Where are you at now in your life? Are you ready? You want to be found by God? Because Moses didn't. You have a question in your life about making some decisions? Because Jacob had some decisions to make. Are you kind of like Samuel, where you're just kind of starting out early and you really haven't learned how to depend upon the Lord daily? You really haven't had some of those struggles in your life just quite yet, so you're not quite sure. Are you willing to get some instruction from an older priest, an older man who has served the Lord for years, and say, "Just say, 'Thy servant heareth you'"? Or are you kind of like Paul, going in the completely opposite direction of what you should be doing? Are you a zealot for religion without being religious? are you doing things that are just backwards to the Christianity and what Jesus Christ would have you do? Is that what you're doing? Well, then I put to it this. When you hear your name called twice from God, Here's all you got to say. What will thou have me do? In some instances, it's real simple. It's just come and join the church. Turn your life around. Be a participant. Serve the Lord. Serve His people. But it starts with, Lord, what would you have me do? If the Lord's calling you now, just say, here I am. You come forward and make that be known and say to me, here I am, and we'll receive you into this body as we stand and sing some song.